Tonight on Arena, director Dervla Walsh on season 2 of Bad Sisters and singer Anoni on her upcoming performance of the songs with Lou Reed at the National Concert Hall. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The much anticipated second season of Bad Sisters is released today on Apple TV. It continues to follow the lives of the Garvey sisters, played by a stellar cast, including Sharon Horgan, Anne-Marie Duff, Eva Berthissel, Sarah Green, Eve Hewson. Have I named all of the sisters there? I think I have. And there is a new character, Angelica. Is the easy part of her name. The Wagon is what the Garvey sisters called her, and she is played by Fiona Shaw. 2 years after the quote-unquote accidental death of Grace's abusive husband, the close-knit Garvey sisters may have moved on, but when the past truths resurface, the ladies are back into the spotlight, suspicions are at an all-time high, lies are told, secrets revealed, and the sisters are forced to work out who they can trust. Delighted to be joined by director and executive producer on Bad Sisters, Dervla Walsh. Fresh, I'm saying, Dervla, from the New York premiere of the new season and the launch last night. How fresh are you?
Just actually about 12 hours fresh. There was some sleep in between. So I'd like to totally blame my vocal cords on a passing flu. But really, it was just cheering and shouting at how it went down last night.
Yeah, I thought you were going to put, I'm going to blame it on Sharon, Anne-Marie, Eva, Sarah and Eve. Abdicating all responsibility. I suppose that the immediate question is, Dervla, you know, season one was such a runaway success. It was a perfect package. It wrapped up beautifully. And sometimes you best say that was a joyous moment. Let's leave it be and move on. What persuaded you that season two was a good idea?
Well, it took a little persuasion, and when Sharon approached me first and said, "What, you know, let's go again," I was going, exactly all the things you've just said. But then she pitched what the idea was, and you know, sometimes you can feel with the second series that it's a cynical approach just to kind of keep a brand alive. And when she talked through the idea, there was kind of no cynicism to it. You know, it still had the substance of abuse and coercive control at the heart of it. And you know, ultimately, it was, can lightning strike twice? And you know, and what are the longer term effects of course of control and abuse. So that kind of substance at the heart of it, and then the absolute excitement at getting back on the floor of the set with the five girls made it a very easy decision.
And that aspect of it, Dervla, the fact that coercive control and domestic abuse that Anne-Marie Duff's character in particular faces and had to deal with in season one of Bad Sisters, is that more to the fore, would you say, in season two? Because I've watched some of it at this point in time. Yes, there are very upsetting moments within it, but there are also joyous and hilarious moments within it.
I mean, we arrive back with a bang. We literally start with, we start first with a little dark moment at the edge of a cliff in Donegal. Literally, we start with a cliffhanger. and then we move on to an Irish hen party at the Leopardstown Races. So, you know, all that goes with that. And then to a wedding. And there is actually so much joy. You're going, oh my gosh, this can't last for long. Because as we all know, secrets don't stay in the grave, are hidden for long. And you just get moments of kind of just flickers in Anne-Marie's beautiful Grace's character. You see, finally, she's happy, she's smiling, she's got the life that she wants, she's got love again. And then you just see, you know, just moments of being unsettled, and she's like a swan, elegant above water, and just there's a lot happening underneath the surface.
A lot of stuff going on underneath, for sure. Well, of course, one of the things that's making her so happy is that she is about to be married, and in that opening scene we see an Irish wedding. Yes. Yeah, what a great thing to manage to get into the very first episode. She's marrying the character of Ian played by Owen McDonald. So there's a lot of joy there, although I'm wondering what way he's going to develop. I'll wait and see what that will be, and I won't ask you to tell me.
No, definitely. You know, we can believe in love.
Yeah, we can. We can, for sure.
But We're not anti-love with the Bad Sisters.
Yeah, although they all have their hurts and difficulties within that. But
exactly.
That, I guess, is the way many people would say love is. Let's have a listen to the wedding morning. Of course all of the sisters are together, and of course they're shouting and telling each other to get up and get a move on. We don't need to try to explain who's who, except that you will probably hear, I think, all of the voices here: Sharon Horgan, Anne-Marie Duff, Eva Berthistle, Sarah Green and Eve Hewson, all trying to get ready for their sister's wedding, and in the case of Grace, her own wedding.
Jesus, it's your sister's wedding. Take a day off.
Oh. It was an hour. I've been up since 5 rolling pastry, sticking up your hole. That was brilliant. Great, thank you.
You're pretty slow today.
Golf oiling. You don't think 5 smoked salmon's a bit excessive, no?
No, I don't think so. No.
Don't mention sea salmon.
Oh! There she is.
Shut up.
The most important person of the day, chief bridesmaid.
Head flower girl, actually.
All the other ones have taken the bridesmaid spots.
Cheek?
Oh, Mum said she's ready for you now.
Oh, does she? Princess Grace. Oh, it's 11:40. Let's go.
Wait. Fish hands.
Oh God, yeah. Where the hell's Becca? Becca! Get up, you lazy cow!
There you go. So Becca Eve Hewson, we don't actually hear because she's upstairs involved in other matters. I should have explained that Sharon Horgan is on a treadmill at the very beginning of that scene.
Yes, Sharon is just in from her morning run, because Sharon is now dealing with the menopause and all things that come with it. And she's off the booze the last couple of years and basically trying to do everything, you know, live somewhat healthily as the hormones are attacking her. And that particular clip actually sounds much more controlled on radio than it does on television. On television, when you see tonight, there are smoked salmons everywhere. There's booze. It's a classic Irish house on the morning of an event, and the way Sharon leans into the comedy of we must have at least a few smoked salmons here and there.
and I guess that speaks to the nature of the ensemble here, because as you say, it does kind of sound controlled when you're just hearing the audio.
Yes.
Visually, there's an awful lot going on.
Yeah.
And I'm sure within, and I think it was the first episode you directed, and maybe one or two later on as well, Dervla.
Yeah.
You do get the sense that this ensemble, I presume it comes from their working together in season one. I mean, they're so well knitted together, and they do play as a group. There's no one star. There are 5 or 6 stars.
Absolutely. I mean, it is... they're amazing to work with, and they do work so powerfully and joyfully as a unit, as a group of sisters, but yet have all their distinct characters. As a group of actresses, when we started last year, I mean, I think they all really connected with their parts. They loved the idea of playing sisters. None of them have experience of murdering anybody, but they all had experience of people who annoyed them and wanting to bury the occasional prick here or there. So they were really able to draw on things close to home. And they're just their generosity as actors. They're kind of their you know, how in control and how brilliant they are at their craft. Like, I guess I didn't realise Eve Hewson had as much comedy in her. Eva Berthistle, I mean, she stands out in this second series with her comedy. We all know Sharon is just fantastic. She can just kind of read the telephone book and make it sound funny. And then Sarah Green is, you know, so perfectly cast as BB.
Yeah, and while they all have those comic moments, there's something emotional, kind of an emotional depth in each of their stories that needs to be explored as well. That balance seems to be important to the series between the comedy and the drama.
Yeah, I think we worked very hard at the tone of it. last year and in getting that, because there is a real kind of, you know, the it's adapted from a Belgian series and it's very different from that series. And I think Sharon did an amazing job at, you know, at Irishizing it, at characterizing it, you know, with a very recognizable family and this kind of connection between the sisters. And we worked very hard to kind of give it, make the world they live, you know, Dublin, a character in the story as well. I mean, often so many stories about women take place, and you know, at one level it's quite a domestic story, you know, takes place in kitchens. So it was like, how do you elevate it so that it doesn't feel like a kitchen sink drama? So we kind of really tried to open out the world of it.
Yeah, I wondered about that as well, in terms of, it's a very contemporary, it's a very modern Ireland that we're seeing, and more than five modern Irish women, several modern Irish women. It's a contemporary moment. When you're speaking to people internationally and you say, oh, it's an Irish comedy, are they expecting something different from that modern Ireland that you're giving them?
I think potentially they did, and I was really conscious that it didn't. You know, we've had so many Irish stories, so many people come in, you know, from the States and tell Irish stories and kind of romanticise it to some degree. Yeah. And sometimes often the stories we tell ourselves from within are kind of... you know, are very bleak for rightful reasons. And so many stories set in Dublin, I feel, are about kind of, you know, drug lords and crime. And so it was actually kind of brilliant to be able to tell, you know, a story that ultimately is about the bonds of love and the loyalty of family. And that has something very, you know, deep and important to say at the heart of it, that I think all of us people who've talked to me after it, or even people within the show talk about, they recognise, you know, whether it's a sister or a friend or somebody who's in a relationship that isn't the healthy relationship. And Sharon's talent is to be able to kind of, you know, address those issues in a very kind of non-direct way, in a very character-filled and, you know, with such great comedy.
Kind of sideways, the Irish property crisis is part of it. But this was in the production. Am I right in thinking that the house in which the sisters are the house that you used in season one was subsequently knocked down and you had to go rebuilding it? Tell us the story of that.
I mean, that was actually such a trauma. You know, when we started out, there was no intention of a second series. So, you know, we shot it during COVID, and we were looking for a house that, you know, very much a house that told the story of family, that, you know, Eva was left with, their parents have died. So we wanted something that kind of had a sense of, you know, history and kind of love and stories of the past, and not kind of a, you know, not a modern build. So eventually we discovered this house that had just been sold in Howth, and it was, you know, compared to its neighbours, it was a very kind of humble house in the middle. And anyhow, we paid the builder not to do anything with it for the summer, so that we could, and we shot around the conservatory. So as soon as we were finished, he basically, you know, did what he had planned to do, was flattened it. And there is now, I just actually saw a picture in a paper recently, a kind of, you know, a Taj Mahal there. And so the big challenge when it was the second series was, oh my gosh, you know, the house was so iconic. How do we? I don't know whether I was like a property developer or a kind of a government minister looking for a place one could build. You know, that would be,
welcome to the Irish property market.
And we eventually found, just to say, we eventually found a field in Wicklow that a farmer very kindly allowed us. He moved his cows from one section to another, and we rebuilt the back of it. And you're just coming at it through different angles this time.
Let us have a listen to the arrival of a new character, the wagon, as she is referred to, played by the wonderful Fiona Shaw. She is the sister of Roger. People will remember the Michael Smiley character, who's aware of what happened at the end of season one. He's aware of everything that went on. And again, we won't say too much for those who haven't watched season
Nicely
one.
Nicely said.
Yeah. So here's a little interaction with the character of Angelica. They're at the races. This is it's gone out of my head again.
Leopardstown.
Leopardstown. That's the place searching for in my head. Yeah. And again, we'll hear several of the sisters here roaring on their horses along the way.
Look!
Lucy, how are you? Long time no see.
Hey, Roger. I'm Grant. Angelica! It's so good to see you. I'm sorry I haven't been in touch.
Not at all. I'm just delighted to see you. You're looking so well.
Thanks. How are you?
I just poured myself into this morning. I just poured.
Oh, you must remember my sisters.
Yeah. Hi. How are you?
Look at the Nolans, what? And this one, the beauty of the family. A little birdie tells me that you and Ian are getting married.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, it was all a bit of a whirlwind.
So finally you put this fellow out of his misery.
Oh, no.
He's always held a candle for her.
Angelica.
I'm only joking with you. Sure. Giving up on all that. Did he tell you that cohabitants we are now? Oh, God. Oh. They got the Kitty Rodri. A wee tip for the next race, girls.
Oh, yes.
Harry Styles.
Oh.
I'm just going to put a few quid on. Delighted. Thrilled to have just bumped into you, Gracie.
And you too. And again, I'm sorry for not getting in touch.
I wish you.
Harry Styles is the name of the horse.
Harry Styles. It's so interesting listening to these clips on radio because
they're different.
As powerful as Sharon's dialogue is, also what is a real power of the show are the non-verbals, the subtext, what the reactions are between all the sisters as people talk, how things land.
Yeah, and certainly we even get a sense of it there, the tension that Fiona Shaw's character brings into the house. And I'm sure that's only, if I can lead on from Harry Styles, that's only heading one direction as season two develops. Season three, Dervla, finally to finish up.
We are in the same position that we were at this time in season one. There is no, this story has a beginning, middle and end. So there is no plan for a season three. There was only a season two because people responded so incredibly to the series. And Sharon had an idea. There are no, but by her own admission, she has no ideas at the moment. So people should watch this in the surety that it does have an end. Yeah. It has a beginning, middle and end.
Although
hopefully a very satisfying one.
Yeah, Sharon did say she had no ideas at the moment. So we will watch that space.
Yes.
Dervla, congratulations on the success of season one, and let us hope that season two brings us similar joy and happiness. Thanks for speaking with us this evening.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's Dervla Walsh and Bad Sister. Season two is available on Apple TV right now. In 2003, Lou Reed played the Helix in Dublin, and among his collaborators on stage that night was an extraordinary singer and musician, Anoni, then known as Anthony Hegarty. Anoni is British-born, New York-based, and she returns to Dublin on the 26th of November to the National Concert Hall to celebrate and commemorate her former collaborator and friend in a show called Dark Blue, Anoni Sings Lou Reed. Many of you will know Anoni from her album I Am Bird Now, which she recorded as Anthony and the Johnsons in 2005, and which won the Mercury Prize. Her latest album, My Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross, was released last year. Delighted to be speaking with Anoni on the programme this evening. First of all, let's hear the opening of Fistful of Love from the album I Am Bird Now, a track to which Lou Reed contributed vocals and guitar.
I was lying in my bed last night, staring at a ceiling full of stars, when it suddenly hit me, I just have to let you know how I feel.
We live together in a photograph. into your eyes, and the seas open up to me. I tell you I love you, and I always will. And I know you can't tell me. I know you can't tell me. So I'm left to pick up the hints, the little symbols of your devotion. So I'm left to pick up the hints, the little symbols of your devotion. And I feel your fist.
Fistful of Love there from the album I Am Bird Now, featuring the voices of Anoni and Lou Reed, and delighted that Anoni is on the line with me this evening ahead of her appearance at the National Concert Hall towards the end of the month, singing the songs of Lou Reed. I just wonder, Anoni, as you listen there in 2005 when the record was made, you hear Lou Reed's voice, that wonderful open spoken stanza that is at the beginning of that song. What kind of memories does it bring back?
Yeah, I mean, he's such a powerful figure, and his voice, it's true, just the texture of his voice just kind of puts the hairs up on the back of your neck. It's like, it's so rich. And I know that sound so well because I was his backup singer for a few years at that point. And I never dreamed that he would just couldn't make an appearance on one of my songs, and it was just total audacity with which I asked him to do so, and he just was so up for it and kind of changed everything. I was lying in my bed and that stanza of text that he speaks just popped in my head, and I wrote it down, and I just knew that was what he was going to say. But the thing that was amazing about that track was his guitar playing.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always been so obsessed with his guitar playing. I mean, as his backup singer, basically, I got to know the hand of his guitar playing really, really well. Like the way he moved through it, almost like the claw of a bear. He would claw at his guitar in this really intense way. And it was so emotional, so visceral. Yeah. And then he just pulled out this kind of death ray sound with his guitar for this recording this day. And everyone just kind of was astonished. He also played the rhythm guitar on the track. So he played the rhythm guitar when we were doing the basics, and then he overlaid these death ray songs. The whole track was basically recorded live with the horns, and everyone was all together in the same room. And tiny room, I think it's called Second Story Studios.
Yeah, it has that feel of it. It has almost the feel of a live performance, as you say, apart from those bits that had to be overlaid within it as well. Interesting that you use that image of the claw of a bear, which in turn can be so gentle and so destructive, you know, the claw of a bear.
Exactly.
And that feel is there in that song. Sometimes, you know, there's such a darkness in Fistful of Love. I feel your fist and I know it's out of love, and I feel the whip and I know it's out of love. It is quite a difficult lyric to get your head around sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I haven't sang it for years. You know, it was like the audacity, it's like kind of the nerve of youth that compelled me to kind of write such an aggressive lyric. I would never write a lyric like that now, and yet it was bound to some of Lou's catalogue in a way to his album Berlin, and conversations about dark or complicated dynamics in love, and especially like when it includes aspects of trauma, you know, and you know, how people who are traumatized in love feel and how they navigate dangerous situations. You know, yeah. You know what kinds of survival strategies people employ when they're with someone that they're also afraid of. You know, I mean, there's so much in that kind of a conversation, and certainly that conversation has moved forward since the days when I wrote that song. I actually wrote that song when I was like 21 years old, yeah. And I used to perform it in the nightclubs in New York just by myself.
Yeah, and that is, we're talking about, as I said, 2005 for that album, but you had been Lou Reed's backing singer, and of course you had been with Lou Reed at the Helix in Dublin in 2003. Now I'm really going to ask you to dig up your memories. I don't know what you remember of that tour. I don't know if you remember even the Dublin leg of it, Anoni.
I remember that tour really well because it was so intense. You know, it was... It was the tour around the time that he released the album, The Raven. And it was me and Mike Rathke. James Carpentoni was playing cello. Fernando Saunders was playing the bass. I don't know if there's anyone else on stage with us. And then Lou. And then Master Ren, his Tai Chi teacher, was on the road with us too. So it was quite wild. It was like a bit of a traveling circus. And but it was very emotional. Like, He kind of took requests from us at the beginning and said, what song should I sing for this tour? And I remember I was like, well, you should definitely do Venus in Furs. You know, you should definitely, you know. And I was learning about his catalog as it went on. I wasn't familiar with a lot of his solo catalog, you know, stuff from Street Hassle. And then his newer songs, he had this one song called Vanishing Act, which was on The Raven, which was an absolutely beautiful song. It was just like him with a piano. It was quite an existential, celestial song in a way, very romantic. And it had that. The tour definitely had the same thing that you described, those two polar and sometimes conflicting values of tenderness and threat in a way, you know.
A couple of years later then, well, in fact, a year after the album I Am Bird Now in 2006, I have a recording of Candy Says. Who first suggested to you that you might sing this with Lou? Did you suggest it to him? Did he suggest it to you?
Well, I first met Lou because a producer named Hal Wilner, who was a really crucial kind of central act of the experimental and sort of underground and above ground music scenes in New York. He was sort of you would know him because he did shows even in Dublin and so forth. But he used to curate these sort of special events with everyone involved and create these circles of community amongst a whole array of musicians from all these different sectors. And it was Hal who got my CD. It was basically a self-release CD of one of the, in 2000, and gave it to Lou among a pile of 10 CDs for Lou to consider guest vocalists, you know. And he said to Hal, I want that voice. And Hal brought me in to the studio and said, well, just want to warn you, if Lou doesn't like your voice, you're just going to be escorted out of the studio. He may not even speak to you. And I was like, okay, well, whatever, I'm up for it. You know, I was very much just a downtown New York performer at that point. He had me sing Perfect Day and against this really different sort of arrangements, kind of amorphous kind of keyboard arrangement. And that was really the beginning of our relationship. My voice just like tickled a nerve in his imagination. And I think he always liked that juxtaposition of his hard voice and my kind of more fluid voice. We did a whole bunch of recording. I ended up doing a bunch of background vocals for the whole record of Raven. And I guess we started to become friends. And we were in a taxi. I remember driving across the village. And I just said to him, you know, there's a song of yours that I love so much, Candy Says. And he said, oh, it's just waiting for you to sing it. It's just waiting for you to sing it. You know, he said it with his really rough voice. And I thought, oh my God. He'd come to see me do a show at this little tiny club called Joe's Pub, and I'd sang Candy Says. He and Laurie were there, and that's when I met Laurie Anderson, and they had loved it. And it was just very, very intimate. And then when I did this show in November of 2011, I invited him to come and sing it with my band. And we played it. You know, the Johnsons at that point was kind of like almost like a little trio with an adjacent string group, and we played it in almost like a very gentle kind of jazz way, and he sang it the crap out of it. He just he growled through that song, and it was probably the first time he sang it in a long time. It was just kind of mystical, really. It was, I was stunned at the way that we were speaking across generations of sort of underground New York experience. Yeah. Like there was this kind of communing of like these basic themes that had also been, would become so central to the album of mine, I'm a Bird Now, ended up featuring a picture of Andy Darling on the cover. So it was a prelude to that. You know, we developed a relationship around the song Candy Says. He ended up having me sing Candy Says as the encore or the final song of the every show we did on tour. He would introduce me to audiences all across Europe, America, Australia, South America, and he would introduce me and he would insist that people listen to me sing Candy Says. And he would play the guitar and would just be the two of us, basically. Yeah. And he was determined that people to give me a platform as a singer.
Amazing version of Candy Says from a gig in Brooklyn in 2006, and only with us on the programme this evening on Arena ahead of her appearance at the National Concert Hall. You talked about spine-tingling experiences listening to Lou Reed. That is a spine-tingling performance, just the two of you.
Yeah, that was... And as he got older, his voice just got so raw. Like, it's almost like he's in between notes everywhere. It's so conversational and he's so very, very direct. He was a really powerful performer.
Yeah, there's a kind of a poetic quality within it. But extraordinary too when you think Candy Says was written in the 1960s by Lou Reed, and he put himself into the mind of this transgender woman.
I think he got it. You know, I think he came from a world where that wasn't so other. You know, I don't think that was such an othered experience for him. I think it was part of the world he was part of. He got it.
Has something changed along the way that experience was othered, or is that part of the world that Lou Reed and artists of that time were living in, that everybody was other because they weren't the same as you?
No, I would say Lou had a unique access to like a very diverse cosmos of people in New York City and was interested in that world and became kind of adjacent part of it, you know? And I think also the Warhol scene was like a kind of a queer underground scene in many respects, but not in the same way that it is now. Now I think the lines are more policed and patrolled and things within one perceived as one genre or algorithm of cultural experience are separated out from a thoroughfare of other experiences. And I think in those days things were cross-pollinated a lot more. Like even I noticed it when Lou presented my record, I'm a Bird Now. I mean, I always explain myself as a transgender person, but the record really was received in the general thoroughfare of culture, you know, in a way that doing a record now, even if it's a record just about, you know, really addressing themes particular of the environment, like it's harder for the general population to get access to my work. It's really substreamed towards people that within one demographic in a way that is kind of limited in its vision for who the audience of the work really is. Like, I think that was what was interesting about I'm a Bird Now, is that kind of everyone heard it, you know, and made their way through the themes and the ideas of it. You know, it had a broad moment of reflection, you know, about these specific themes, you know, in a way that maybe would be more difficult to achieve now.
Absolutely. You're playing the National Concert Hall, as I said, and only on the 26th of the month. How difficult is it to choose a set list of Lou Reed songs? Because I presume it will all be Lou Reed's music that you'll be singing, possibly your own Fistful of Love. Maybe there are other songs that will be in there as well. But how have you gone about compiling and curating that set list?
It's been an odyssey, I have to say, because I've been listening to his records and like some of them I still haven't heard all the songs. There's so many songs from different periods and some of them really surprised me. It's been a real odyssey. You know, I've gone through scores and scores of songs and some of the ones I've approached, I've realized, you know, I've thought, wow, this is so powerful. I should try and sing this. And then I realized there's no way I can embody this. You know, this is the point of view of this song is so foreign to me. Like I can't really put it forward. So I had to really choose songs that make sense for me. At first I was drawn to some of the most kind of, even some of the most ballistic elements of his catalog. And now I realize, oh no, I don't think I can. I think I'll just leave that to the master and let me do things that I can expand on in a way that he would have liked, you know.
I'm guessing if Perfect Day was, did you say it was the first song you sang from him? It's bound to feature. Yeah,
but Perfect Day was one of them. And, you know, I mean, I love songs like, you know, I'm Set Free. And, you know, I kept circling that song with Blue Mask, but I cannot do it, you know, to save my life. I can do it, but I'll just go hoarse. You know, and that some of the songs that he wrote for Nico and are particularly beautiful, and also songs that I sang at his memorial. I sang Femme Fatale. I don't know. It's a whole kind of swirl of things.
It may have changed before the 26th when you get here.
I didn't get to Ireland yet on the tour, this recent tour that I did for my most recent album. So it's funny to come and do a concert in Ireland for the first time in many years of Lou's material. But I thought if anywhere they would want to hear it, probably be Dublin.
Will there be a bundle of Hegartys there?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be a speckling. You know, you know, I've got Hegartys all over the country. So, but you know, a lot of my family live out in Donegal, which is also where, you know, I live part of the year. Mm. But yeah, there'll be a few family members there.
You might finish up, if you wouldn't mind, and only by leading us into Sliver of Ice, because I think it speaks directly to your experience with Lou Reed.
Yeah, it was a song I wrote after he passed away. It was based on a conversation that we had where he'd had this kind of almost ecstatic experience. Like he was in his house up in the Springs, which is like he had this kind of house that he shared with Laurie, and he was having more and more difficulty, you know, physically. And he'd had a liver transplant. He was kind of in decline, and he was very curious about the whole process. Like he approached the whole process of leaving his body with a lot of curiosity and rigor. He was really into developing a practice of resilience and strength in the later part of his life, you know, physically and also mentally. He was forever encouraging me to be more rigorous you know, you know, in fortifying myself. But it was really his path. You know, I'm quite of a more of a oceany type person. You know, anyway, he was saying that it was at some point that one of his assistants had put some ice in his mouth because he was dehydrated, and he just said it was just like this incredible experience, feeling this sensation of this cold in his mouth, and that it kind of gave him this feeling of delight and rapture. It was just amazing. It was amazing to be shown what that path towards leaving the body can include, you know, that it can include this kind of really almost like sensual appreciation of one's physical experience. And but it also kind of echoes through the song, is this kind of some of these kind of themes of where am I going, you know.
And Oni, thank you so much for being with us on Arena this evening.
Oh, my pleasure. I can't wait to do a show in Dublin. It's been a while.
And a lot of people will look forward to you doing just that. We'll finish with Sliver of Ice, and I'll give people the details once again of the National Concert Hall gig after this.
Bye. Thanks.
Just the opening there of the wonderful track Sliver of Ice from Anoni's latest album, My Book Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross. Dark Blue, Anoni sings Lou Reed, is at the National Concert Hall in Dublin just under a fortnight's time, Tuesday the 26th of November, nch.ie for full details. This winter, the Abbey Theatre brings us the European premiere of a new adaptation of Jane Austen's Emma by American playwright Kate Hamill. The story revolves, of course, around the charming and flirtatious Emma Woodhouse and her meddling in the lives and relationships of her upper-class, and maybe not upper-class, friends and neighbours in Regency period rural England. Tony O'Rourke plays Emma in this new production, which is directed by Claire O'Reilly, and I'm delighted that both Tony and Claire are with me in studio this evening. She is quite the character, this Emma one, Tony. I think one of the big challenges with Emma is she sticks her nose in everywhere and meddles with everybody's business. But we kind of have to like her for all of that, don't we?
Yes, yes, she sure does. I think she's a brat. She is a messer. Like, she's very messy in each other's, in everyone's business, and trying to navigate that and trying to control everything, I would say. Mm-hmm. But we do. It is really interesting. We actually spoke about how Jane Austen spoke and said that Emma was written as a dislikable character, and yet she is one of the most likable ones, because apparently we all love a bit of a messy
control
gal.
Freak.
A control freak messy gal.
Yeah.
But no, she is. She's a lot of fun, and she's, as you said at the start, she's like flirtatious and hilarious and very loving and very curious.
Yeah, able to fix everybody's life up except her own.
Except her own. The most compelling part.
Yeah, well saved, Claire O'Reilly, director there. What was it about this particular adaptation that attracted you, Claire? Because Kate Hamill, I was looking at her bag, I think her intention is to adapt all of Jane Austen's books, and she's adapted several other novels as well. She seems to like that book to stage journey.
Yes, and she's so prolific. I think she'll be successful in that pursuit ultimately. I actually was approached with this adaptation. But I was immediately drawn to it, and I understand why they had me in mind to direct it, because it's so fun. It's got so much momentum. I mean, I enjoy the novel, but I wouldn't say it has the most momentum of every classic fiction. And this is just, just full of flirt. And it does a really good blend of the then and the now in terms of Regency and contemporary.
And you spoke to Kate Hamill, I believe, about the production. One of the things that let me read something that she says at the beginning of her script. I won't read all of it. This, more than any other script I've written, is a very precise, heightened language comedy. Please say the words as written, quoting Shakespeare or paraphrasing Shakespeare, even when they're strange. I'm not going to attempt anything. Please pay attention to when the characters are using capital letters and the like. Please use the language. Don't add any extra sounds or verbal gesticulations. she's very fussy.
She's precise. She is.
Well, saved again.
I think when I initially read that, I similarly had some curiosities about the level of detail to which she goes into there.
Yeah.
But then when I spoke to her, unlike any of the other productions, all of our Irish cast are using their accents. So we've got accents from all across the country.
Right.
Whereas in the previous iterations, it's American actors doing British RP. So it's much
received
more specific.
Yeah.
Received pronunciation, yes. So I spoke to her saying there might be a little bit of elasticity needed there, because things will sound different in the Irish accent. But it's funny, as we've been working it, we found that sticking to what she offers is often the correct way to do it.
We have a character called Miss Bates, which is also in the novel.
And played by Claire Barrett, isn't it? Yeah,
exactly. And hearing that in an Irish accent, you think it is written for it. It's remarkable. We all know a Miss Bates.
And actually, to be fair to Kate Hamill, further down at the end of that paragraph, she says, I know this sounds like a picky playwright stuff, but this is the math of screwball comedy. And listening to the two of you pattering off each other there, is that what's going on in the rehearsal room? That kind of, it's the speed of the delivery that seems to be really important here, Tony.
Well, what's wonderful about that, Sean, is we're on our best behaviour. So there's a lot more pattering happening.
You're speaking slowly at the moment, are you?
Slowly.
Yeah. You're doing patter.
And not screaming and laughing down the mic. But yes, there is. The momentum is there and the rhythm is very much in the room. We are having such a ball. I mean, we're in week 5 and it's unbelievable how much joy. We keep saying it's radical joy every single day to play with this script and also to play with one another. It's a remarkable cast and led by our formidable Claire. And it's just, yeah, it's a real gift. I have to stop using that word in my lexicon, but I keep being given gifts. So
couldn't be further away from when we spoke last of The Boy That Never Was, which was such a dark and heavily emotional piece. I guess that's the joy of acting, isn't it? That you can go from one thing to the other over the space of a few weeks.
It's so true. It's so lovely to be in a joyous space now as well, coming up to Christmas. And yeah, it's different. As you say, it's the spectrum of acting and meeting it, but also finding the truth in every character, because, you know, there is also grief and nuance and lots of different levels to even Emma, you know, and you'll find that.
One of the things that I noticed within the script, that there's this little section, I think it's actually you, Tony, that has to deliver this, where she says something. Now, I need to give you, I'm paraphrasing, sorry, Kate Hamill, I need to give you a little bit of exposition here and explain who these characters are. And I think it's actually Jane Fairfax.
Jane Fairfax.
Yeah, little Miss Perfect. But we do get sections that are almost like a little paragraph from the novel delivered directly out to the audience.
Yes. Our fourth wall is well and truly broken. Yeah. So there's a lot of direct addresses happening and conversation and communication happening with our audience, which is really, really fun and so playful and alive. And I'm really, really excited for that to be different.
Yeah, because I guess you've been doing it in the rehearsal space at the moment, so you're just playing it out to...
I'm eyeballing Claire for all...
But when you have an audience in the Abbey...
Audience. You are such a warm audience.
that'll be a different experience when you've 400 or 500 people out in front of you.
For sure. And, you know, there are questions to the audience, and if people want to answer me, maybe they will.
Yeah, they're allowed to heckle or at least talk back. That's the intention.
Well, yeah, maybe. Please, yes. Well, look, it's a conversation, whether that be verbal or not.
Yes, yeah.
But it will change every night, which I just can't wait.
And one of the things that I love is that Kate Hamill has within the script the idea that you actually do refer to the theatre that it's in. You refer to the people in the production team and things like that. She wants that to be part of the show. It's not a pretense that it's anything other than a performance.
No, that's right. It's my turn to use the word gift. As a director, that is so beautiful, because it means, I mean, we're taking this fictional town in a British Regency novel via an American screwball lens and then setting it in the Irish National Theatre with Irish actors. So it's amazing to just go, we know we're here, we're in the theatre, we're acknowledging that, and it means that all of our choices after that can be a blend of those things.
And the language, while some of the language in the script is quite definitely that of Jane Austen, there's also very contemporary language in there. What about this, the soundtrack that's going to be here? I know in previous iterations there have been very much the music of this period, the 20th century, the 21st century.
That's right, yeah. And actually we should pay Kate's playwright note their, her dues, because she actually has a note in there saying please feel free to play with all of that blend of contemporary and more period styles. So we've been using the term, it's hyperpop meets harpsichord. So there is kind of those two elements are existing together. Yeah, and that goes for social etiquette. We've been very playful with that and the vernacular yeah. and the images.
We're in Bridgerton country in some ways here, are we, Tony?
I wouldn't say it's definitely not Bridgerton. I think hyperpop and hyper-regency, which is kind of this idea of the maximalist idea that we're bringing this world into a contemporary notion. And we spoke about like the costumes in, for an example of that is like, we're playing with the Empire Line, which Claire was actually saying earlier, but we're playing with the Empire Line, which is now back around, and how like costume and how fashion right. is so cyclical, and we're dealing with that again. So, yeah, so
the look and the sound will be contemporary as well as Regency. There'll be a mix of that.
Exactly.
In there.
And very playful. It's very theatrical and silly and playful. And
you'll be delighted to hear this, that a listener called Brona has just texted to say that she's got tickets for Emma for her daughter and her granddaughter. I guess that cross-generational thing is exactly what you're looking for.
Delighted.
Yeah.
Hi, Brona.
Thank you so much. And you can say, she can say hello to you in the night, sure, if she can, wants to shout up. Claire O'Reilly and Tony O'Rourke speaking to us there about Emma, which opens at the Abbey Theatre November the 28th, previews from the 22nd, very close now, runs through until the 25th of January. Great to have work over the Christmas period, I'm sure. abbeytheatre.ie for full details. And that is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields researched, Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, Harry Booklis was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.